Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything.
Hello, it's us. We're back again, the Vicar and the Witch, talking about all kinds of random things. We are going to try to take up once again where we left off last time, which was with Maggie using the word possession to describe her relationship with her dog, which I sort of challenged her on and then kind of chickened out of. Because what we didn't say was that actually one of Maggie's dogs had recently died. And so we were talking about a touchy subject, and so I backed off. And because dogs are so completely part of both her and my life and tribe, and we love them as people, we're going to try and talk about this more. But there's every chance there's going to be lots of tears.
Yes, because that's worse than having to explain Christianity. It was just, and you're going to catch me up on this again, because it was just a word in passing. It was a gesture to Mother Earth that burying the body of my dog was my greatest gift. But I used the word possession. And it really hurts to even... I don't think Callie was my possession. Callie was my friend and all that. But yes, I used the word accidentally, but it really hurts to be taken up on it, actually. So I just have to own that. Because it was me trying to give the great mother my greatest gift. It was my beautiful girl. So, ouch.
Oh, yes. I am sorry. Hot in the pursuit always of this spell.
Yeah, and it's fine. I am absolutely A-okay with being upset, with feeling defensive. I'm feeling, for God's sake, I just used it accidentally. It was my But I'm all right talking about it. And I think it's important that we can highlight the fact that you can use the, not a wrong word, but an inaccurate word. And it is a spell, and it means something to somebody else. When I do a workshop, the amount of times I have to stop and say to people, do you get this? Does this make sense? And quite often, it's the use of the language which means something completely different to them.
Yes.
Than it did to me.
Yes, 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 exactly.
And we can always get round it, but the question always has to be asked. But no buts. Let's talk spells.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk spells.
Well, just that, for me, I was so incredibly taken aback by your use of the word, and that even I mean, as I remember, and I'm ashamed to admit I haven't listened back to it, that when sort of slightly invited to change the word, you didn't, but that we, oh my goodness, language to me is the tool that we use to co-create our reality.
Yes, and we were talking about this with Black Lives Matter, and I was talking to a black guy at Mulhaven yesterday, and I didn't get the language right. He was still appreciative that I spoke with him and addressed the issue and said, is it all right for me to talk to you about this? But I still didn't get the language the way I would have liked to in retrospect, because I just didn't have it. I didn't have it.
And that goes back to one of the things that I am really kind of engaged in a bizarre quest for, which I'm not doing very well at all, actually, which is the attempt to find a word that really, really works, that will do instead of he, she, it or they.
Yes.
To convey my acknowledgement of the livingness of the other beings, like this beautiful apple tree that we're sitting under, that's something more honourable than it. and that...
Or we change our view on it. You see, I'm quite happy to call God it, because I don't have a bad negative phrase on it.
Right, okay, that's interesting.
You know, I don't have a problem with it being an it, but then that's me. And then, again, we've got this now, that if I say God as it, it is going to offend people. I actually have a joke about that in my comedy act, which is that, I say God is not he. So I tried to call it, but that offended people. And if I call it she, that'll offend some people. And if I call it he, that'll offend some people. I tried she, he, it, but that didn't work out terribly well either. But words are, it is a minefield. And yeah, keep going. I mean, do I regard my dogs as my possessions? No. But perhaps part of me does. Oh, if you can hear a little bit of noise in the background, it's a chicken coming to investigate us.
And also the groaning. The groaning that's taking place, as far as I can tell, nearest to the microphone, so it might be significantly louder to a listener than it is to us, is a very happy beagle.
Being stroked on the grass. The other beagle, not the dead one. But yes, keep going, because... The great thing about friendships is you must be able to challenge each other.
Mm, definitely.
And I hope I won't use that word again. But I, not but, because that's yes but. We have to go yes and. It was a word, how often do we use words when we're upset, which I was when I spoke that. And also when I spoke when Callie was buried. How often in grief or anger do we just use the nearest word we've got because we haven't got anything better, and that can cause such offence?
I mean it's interesting that you've just named grief as well for the place where we perhaps lose our words, because it feels to me like there is a massive wave of grief right now.
Oh, yes.
Pretty much everywhere, that everyone seems to be experiencing either a personal grief or what I can only call a kind of existential grief. Like, you know, there are people who can't find, they didn't just lose their dog, they didn't, don't have a reason to feel that they can name or identify, to feel the great wave of grief that's coming up. And that I've had more conversations about weeping in the last week than I've probably had in the last, oh God, I don't know, 6 months, a year, ages. Mm. Because the grief around all the things that are bubbling up in our mutual psyche at the moment, from lockdown, from being slightly let out of lockdown, from climate, from all the challenges that our mental health we're undergoing as a society in terms of our mental health through lockdown. And then also that even those of us who are completely happy in lockdown and going either, well, it's not that different, or I love this, are still surrounded by people who we love who are having a really difficult time in lockdown. And that, therefore, when you're in a field, the whole world, it feels to me, is full of, in our field, is grief and is this upsurge of, well, I need to cry and here's why. And maybe I'm giving myself permission to, and maybe I'm not. And then, you know, that brings its own kind of second swell, if you like, because as a society we're not very good at dealing with other people's grief, and we're not very comfortable with holding one another while we cry, typically. And that in amongst all that, then there's all this potential for miscommunication at a time where everyone's so tender.
Yeah.
And that amongst our tenderness, if we can pay attention to our words, maybe we've got the greatest opportunity ever to start to create a world that's really where we're holding all of life, each other, those other beings that we love, whether they've got four legs or two legs, a beak or a nose, branches or wings or whatever, in the kind of mutual respect that can then nourish our hearts in a way that will salve our grief. And to me, that feels like, that sounds ludicrously simplistic. And yet I really do believe it's what's necessary right now, and that it would be an incredible healing for all of us.
I actually don't think that these are individual griefs. I think this is a communal grief.
Yeah, me too.
Stephen Jenkinson, the Orphan Wisdom guy, wrote Die Wise and many other wonderful books about death and dying and grief, says that if to be a human is to grieve. You have to grieve for everything you kill, grieve for everything you pull up, grieve for all the sorrow. Wisdom's must grief, it's sorrow, that life is love and sorrow, life and death. So I think one of the issues around the grief that people are experiencing is that we don't realise that this is a communal grief. This is the great grief coming up, because it's been despised, rejected, thrown out, covered over, replaced, all those things. And let's go deep into that in a minute, but I'm not trying to catch you out here, but I just wanted to say that a phrase you used in there gave me a jolt.
Which was?
You said, who hasn't just lost a dog, and what you meant was recently.
Yes, I did, yeah.
But the word just can be a word that means only. It's only lost a dog.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? So I actually got the, when you said that word just, in exactly the same way as you would have got the, when I said possession.
Yeah.
So it's, wow, well, how do we do this?
Oh, I know. Do you know what? This is so interesting. I was having a conversation with somebody literally just the other day, and the two themes in our conversation that came up were these words. There's a word for words that mean two opposing things.
An oxymoron?
No, it's a duonym or something.
Right.
I can't remember.
Well, we know what it means.
Anyway, we know
yes,
what it
a word that
there
means
There are loads
two,
of
yes.
them. A word yeah. that means two opposing things. There are absolutely loads of them in English. And the other thing that has come up over and over again in my conversations over the last week is that this is our collective grief. And that because everything is made up of the same stuff, everything is interwoven, interconnected, we are humans in a living, breathing, sentient world. It's not just mine or yours. It's not only mine or yours.
No.
It's ours, all of us. And that people who haven't got any reason at all that they can think of why here I am sitting on a Wednesday afternoon in the sunshine in you know, yours garden, my garden,
Tuesday.
Anywhere. On a Tuesday. Oh.
I'm sorry, that was unworthy of me. I do apologise.
But whatever. But that, you know, even if I can't identify any reason, and I'm not saying this is true for me at all, if one cannot identify any reason why one might be feeling grief, it's still there.
Yes.
Because it's here in the field for all of us.
Yes. And if we don't acknowledge grief, grief like shock goes into depression if it's not acknowledged, if it's not let out, if it's not experienced. I'm quite sure that an awful lot of the awfully difficult diseases like fibromyalgia are grief. Or grief and resentment, or grief and anger about not being allowed to be me. And of course, ultimately, only you can allow you to be you. But if you're training when you're young, you know, give me a child to the seven, I will give you the man.
Yeah,
it's
really
difficult to get out of a broken vessel. If you've had a broken vessel created as a child, then you will also use the language of your parents. And we get into this woundology with our language too, don't we?
Very much so, yes. Yeah, I know you must have come across the work of Carolyn Mays.
Oh, I adore her. Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, in fact, I believe we've had this, yes. Apologies. We have most definitely had this conversation before. Yeah, but her statement that we can't remember how she puts it very eloquently, but the idea that we kind of define ourselves by the story of our illness, and that means that we can't get better.
Yeah. And I was watching this. This last week we did a Mercy trip. Well, that sounds very patronising. Sorry, I didn't mean it. But a friend of ours who has no family that he's happy with was taken into hospital urgently and was terrified. And it turns out that he's okay. He does need medication. But we went over to bring him home, you know, and be with him for a while because his friends are his family.
Yeah.
And on day two, he was describing all the medicines he had to take to me and the packets and the this and the that and when he had to take them, how he was setting alarms. And a small alarm bell rang in my head. But actually, I've spoken to him since then, since we got home, and he hasn't turned into a wound.
Ah, good.
He's not talking about his medicines again. He's a wise man.
Yeah.
You know, but the rest of us, my reason for living now is taking these medicines because of my illness, because of this. And it does become an identity, and it's a very strong egoic identity. And we need strong egoic identities to be the strong vessel for our true self, for our soul to stand on. But they have to be strong, healthy ones. And we're basically just not taught. It's not the fault of our parents. They weren't taught either.
Yeah.
But certainly in the industrial age, I'm so grateful to my mother for pointing out flowers to me. I remember once saying to her, "How do you know there's a God?"
Oh.
And she said, "Every time I look at a leaf, I know there's a God."
Oh, yes, Maggie's mummy. Yes.
Yes. So even though I may have had all sorts of issues around my mother, those are the kind of things I remember. And reading The Little White Horse, Elizabeth Googie's book, which we've promised we're going to talk about at some point as well.
Oh, let's talk about it now.
Oh, well, okay.
We've got time.
We've got time. Yes, we have. Elizabeth Googe was a Christian mystic. Sorry, I'm
saying. Was she?
Yes, she was. She was very Christian, but she saw things and she heard things. I've read her autobiography, and it's a little like Teresa of Avila's Entering the Castle, in that she dare not speak what she sees because she's a Christian. She was locked down in that language that Christians maybe shouldn't be this mystical, but she wrote wonderful books, including Linnets and Valerians, which includes How to Talk to Bees, that kind of thing. She lived in the countryside. She never married. She was a witch. She was an amazing woman. And she wrote this child's book called The Little White Horse, which has been televised, but never televised as well as the book. And it's both Christian and witchy. And I think that was the seminal book of my childhood. I don't have a copy right now because I just give it away.
Everyone
I know.
I totally get that.
Yes.
Yeah. So last time you said, Maggie, that you made that statement, it was a seminal book of your childhood. Mm. And I heard the words Little White Horse and I was like, oh, I remember that book. And we both went, oh, lovely. And then almost immediately afterwards, but I didn't bother saying it because it was so not relevant, I realised that I was in fact talking about the little wooden horse, not the little white horse.
I read that too.
And that, yeah,
it was a good book.
It was a good book. But that I'd never read The Little White Horse. And so because I think you're an interesting and an amazing woman, I thought I'm going to check out this little white horse. And so I found that it was a total and utter classic, which, despite the fact that it was written in like 1948 or something, you could still buy. So I did, and I read it, and I absolutely loved it. You have to cut it the tiniest bit of slack because it was written in 1948, but tiny, tiny bit of slack.
And it's actually set in the 19th century, I think, isn't it?
Or early 20th. Feels like it is. Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean,
but it's a parallel universe.
And
Yes, there's no cars. And everybody wears long dresses and women wear gloves and hats.
And cloaks.
And cloaks, yes. And it does take place in a sacred valley in a kind of parallel universe. That valley has the parallel universe.
Yes.
And I just loved it for the very beginning, not only for The Little White Horse. I was quite disappointed when it turned out to be a unicorn. You know?
Were you?
I was. But anyway, because it was a seahorse. The horse is coming from the sea that washed things out. But the first thing that really got me, and I'm sorry I'm doing spoilers here, but you'll forget them if you want to read the book.
It's still worth it.
Her imaginary friend is real.
Oh, God, yes. Oh,
in this world.
So gorgeous.
It is paradise.
Yeah.
But paradise has been lost through the selfishness and silliness of two people in love who quarrelled. And it's Mariah's job to heal it. And it's just so simple a book, isn't it?
Yeah.
And she doesn't have to do much. No. She's just got to have the courage to do the simple things, and then everything else leads to everything else. So as a life lesson.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
It is. Really, really beautiful. And that was one of the things that why I was like, you know, yeah, let's talk about it, is because it was one of the, well, there were two reasons I wanted to talk about it. The first is that it was she basically, I'm interested again that you call her Maria. To me, my reading of it was Maria.
Yes, so. Actually, as a child, it was Maria, but I watched a TV show that called her Mariah, and that caught. I would go Maria, generally, yes.
Okay. Was that I was so touched by how simple saving the world was.
Yes.
And all she had to do was to have the bottle to do the right thing. And doing the right thing wasn't that big a deal.
No.
And that, I just think that's a, you know,
yes, because it's
universal life lesson.
It's not the whole of the seven books of Harry Potter. It's not a constant fight and a constant pulling back. It's actually, I am committed to doing this.
Nobody died. And, you know, yeah. But just that's what it takes. That's what it takes.
I'm going to circle back for a second here. I don't think, and this is me sounding terribly judgmental, but I mean it. And I'm not ashamed of it. I don't think that the collective grief of the people in lockdown has been helped by binge-watching Netflix.
I never watched Netflix.
Well, so we don't have Netflix either, but I basically binge-watching anything with death and destruction in it. And
our TV,
well, a lot of stuff. It's dark stuff. And I'm fascinated by pathology and that kind of thing, but I only... The maximum of shows I will watch a week, which include murder, is the maximum is two. And actually, I don't think I should watch that many.
Yeah, I must admit the maximum amount of shows I'll watch that include murder is none.
Mm.
So
yeah,
but I'm not much of a one for telly, really. I'll get sucked into the odd thing. I like a good series every now and then.
Exactly. I love Endeavour, so that's my two deaths a week.
It's okay. I don't know what it is. Yes, it's hopeless talking to me about telly. I don't know who any of the stars are. No, but we are. I don't know any of the programmes.
No, I don't know much either, but we get programmed. Mm. Somebody said, I don't think it was you, it could have been you, but and it might have been Caroline Mace or somebody, just said something that just went straight into my heart and made me go, oh, you idiot, Maggie. And basically said, watching the news is like taking poison.
Mm.
I'm going to say that again. Watching the news is like taking poison. And I'd been checking the BBC and CNN far too often since Brexit.
Yeah.
Even though I do take a full day a week off, I'm thinking, no, you're going to have to take three days. You're not going to do this. This is addictive because you just want to know that little bit more.
I mean, I don't hardly ever watch the news, but what I have watched has been so full of fear that, yes, if I didn't say it, and I'm not sure it was me that said it, I kind of wish I had.
Feel free to.
Yes, I'm going to now. And that, yeah, I don't really understand why it has to be so full of fear, and whatever happened to that, there was a thing on the news, but maybe I just saw a different channel's version of the news, where... They always tried to end with some good news, which seems to have been abandoned, but maybe I was used to watch something else.
And no, it will have been abandoned. Many years ago, the Times, at the wish of Prince Charles, would put half a page of good news on its front page on his birthday every year.
God! Is that all they could manage?
Well, yeah, but it seemed like a start. And they noticed that the sales of the newspaper for that day went down. And so they couldn't get advertising for the front page of the newspaper, which had good news. So they dumped it.
What are we like?
But exactly, what are we like? We are addicted to the negative. We're addicted to watching... I mean, I do watch Endeavour, so I'll include myself in this. We're addicted... We are addicted to watching death and destruction because the hero comes along and sorts it for us.
Okay.
And the flawed hero comes along and sorts it. So we go, okay, that's all right then. I don't know if that's it, but real life is much messier and things don't get sorted.
Well, that, I mean, back to the little white horse.
Mm.
Again, one of the things to absolutely love about that story is that the protagonist doesn't need to be saved.
No.
And she isn't. I mean, she kind of, you know, she is. In terms of the story, she's the heroine. But, I know I'm repeating myself, all her heroism was standing up for truth and integrity and
for the people she loved.
On behalf of love.
Yes, on behalf of love. Yes.
And
as soon as she did that, the universe conspired to help her.
Yes, which it does.
Which it does. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the universe does conspire to help you.
It really does. And, you know, back to that other old theme of ours is, you know, the active and the receptive, the masculine and the feminine. We can all be our own hero, even, and also we can be our own heroine, and we can be our own saviour and saved. And I don't mean that in a Jesus saves you kind of saviory type of way. I just mean on a daily basis, back round to the words, if we can create a story for ourselves where we are powerful in our own lives to co-create with the universe, with the rest of humanity, with the trees and the bees and the birds and the beagles, a world of acknowledgement of our mutual independence and therefore respect and care for our mutual interdependence.
Yeah, and also to look for the connections everywhere.
Mm.
I mean, if I may tell the story of Callie, and I won't be able to tell it without crying, but in fact, how she died.
I'm so sorry.
I was trying to stop me telling her, oh, nice lion she's got on her wallet. We're actually together now. It's wonderful. We can sit together.
We can. Hello, I'm so sorry. We're recording. You have to go. Goodbye. My phone is on the thing where it's on silent unless it's one of my kids, and there's nothing I can do about it except answer them.
Did you need to go back to him?
Well, aren't we still recording?
Yeah, we are still recording. Okay.
I'm sorry.
I will tell my deeply sad story.
I'm so sorry.
And then you can call your son back. Okay, well, maybe that'll light me up. Basically, Callie, our beautiful 13-year-old beagle, she was 13 the day before, I took her and Desi out for a walk. Happy, healthy, strong dog. And carried her down from the moor, dying, because she was kicked by a moorland pony.
Mm.
And it was one of those, it was horrific. It was raining, and she was too heavy. In the end, I had to leave her under a bush and go home and fetch my husband to come back and race her to the homeopathic vet. And there was nothing that could be done because she had internal injuries. But she didn't suffer very much. But it was the shock, and it was utterly, utterly ghastly. And then I thought, I know well enough from the death of other dogs that I have to go into this more and reframe this, because let's look at why would a pony canter across to my dog and attack it? Yes, there was a small herd. Yes, there were two foals. They were 100 yards away, and I was between the herd and the dogs. And I had spoken to the herd.
Mm.
I had said, we mean you no harm.
Mm.
But one of them, a grey pony, came rushing along. I didn't see what she did to Callie, but afterwards, Callie just stood there. And then her head dropped, and then she went down on the ground because something had been ruptured. We did find out that Callie had got a tumour on her spleen, possibly. There was certainly a lump. Yeah. It wasn't obvious when you felt her stomach, but when she lay on her back when she died, you could see that it was there.
Yeah.
We weren't aware of it before.
Yeah.
And I had always said to Callie, because previous dogs have died at the vets or sometimes had to be put to sleep or whatever, and our last dog, I said to her, die at home peacefully in your sleep, please die at home peacefully in your sleep. And she did while I was away. So I've said to Callie, when your time comes, please die peacefully in your sleep while we're here. So we brought her home from the vets, who made her comfortable. She wasn't in pain, but she was just fading.
Yeah.
And she was on the sofa, and she was with us, and she died peacefully in her sleep, which was exactly what I asked her to do. Now, it's quite possible that if the tumour on the spleen is benign, then it's fine. It's not a problem. You just take the tumour off. But if the tumour on the spleen is not benign and you go in, you've killed that dog.
Right.
And that dog is not going to die. It's going to have to be euthanized on the table because the vets know that that dog's going to die in pain if you don't.
Right.
So that was possibly, if it was a malignant tumour, the best way that Callie could possibly die.
Yeah.
And that doesn't stop me grieving for her.
Of course.
But I can actually see that there was good path in that attack, that it was grace.
Yeah.
I could have done without having to carry a half an hour down the hill, but it was grace. And also the other thing that came from it was we have such egos about our dogs, about we worry about them after death. You know, they'll miss us, that kind of thing. Mm. And I went into meditation and went back to the time of Callie's death because I thought, well, I'll just see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I can be there to greet her, because I know you can do that, because I've helped move souls, human souls on. Mm. So I went back in meditation to the time of her death. I saw her wake up. Her eyes lit up and she ran straight through me to somebody else.
Aww.
That she loved beyond measure. And that was such a blessing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how many people I can tell that to, because they want the dog to love them, which is the ego thing. But, and I went back and talked to this man. It was a man. And he identified, he actually said he was the beagle wrangler. He's the angel or the presence that sends them down to be pets.
Yeah.
Involved with humans. And he's the one, that, and they adore him.
Yeah.
So when they die, they go home. And I don't know if that's real, but as you said last week, which was so valuable, we have to behave as if we trust the spirits. And although I miss her so much, she was the best of dogs. What a joy to see her run to somebody she loved, to see her go home.
Yeah. I mean, that is totally in alignment with my own seeing behind the veil of what happens with a dog. And that that for me, the beagle wrangler is I would describe that one as like the kind of the grandparent spirit, if you like, of all beagles.
Yes.
Of which there is a blissful example sitting between Maggie and I with our eyes shut in absolute stroking paradise. But
and there'll be a cock spaniel.
Yeah,
wrangler,
exactly.
And there'll be the great wrangler of all hounds,
yes,
and the great wrangler of all dogs,
yeah, yeah,
and the great, yes.
And they're this kind of grandparent-y, guardian-y person, and they are the one to whom you need to apply for permission when you want to do healing work on a wild animal.
Yes.
Because you can't, well, if you can't ask them directly. So when a creature is our possession, for want of another word, certainly legally our possession, it seems like it's in partnership with them that we can ask them directly, is it okay if I you know, work with you for to do healing or whatever. But when it's a wild animal, if you can't get a sense of, well, I've got their permission directly, that you can go to this, to the beagle wrangler, to the wild pony wrangler, to the whoever, and ask and be in conversation with that one who's got the kind of the umbrella, if you like, of love over them all. And that, yes, that's, oh god, that's so beautiful to think that that's who they run home to.
Yes.
And that yes, you can just imagine that skippy happy homecoming of, it's okay human, thanks, but get out the way.
Yes.
And how beautiful.
Yes, and that's healing for me too, because a couple of dogs ago, a couple of beagles alone, we had one who did have to be put to sleep, and it was a clumsy vet in that she pulled her away from me as soon as to check that she was dead. I know they have to do that, but it was just a bit clumsy and I was very upset and I just turned around and walked away. So I had to sort of go, I was much younger then in many ways, and I used to visualise myself going back to be with the dog, and now I know I didn't have to.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean to say you shouldn't be with your pet if your pet is dying or being put to sleep. I think it's a wonderful thing to be there with them during that process. But I know now that Puzzle ran to the beagle wrangler.
Yes. Hooray. Okay, I 34 suspect minutes. We've massively run out of time.
We're on perfect time, so thank you for listening. Laughter and tears.
Laughter and tears as ever.
Could you get out of the way, dog? I need to turn this off now.